Welcome to Sports Shrinks. I'm one of your hosts, Tiffany, and this is.
I am Katie.
We're just so glad that you all are choosing to listen to us, and thanks for being here. Katie, how have you been?
I've been great. I'll be honest, like the anticipation of this book launch has me a little uneasy. It feels like I actually put a post on our social media page about this recently that the I mean, I haven't been a competitive athlete in like decades now at this point, but this book writing process is the closest I have felt to a competitive athlete because it's so consuming and requires like so much bandwidth. And it's just like all in, which is so great in so many ways. But this now being in this like anticipatory part of it, which feels like in prep of a big competition. It's uneasy. It's uneasy, but exciting. You know, that kind of like mixed bag of it all of like ready for it to be here and also scared and nervous and worried and hopeful and excited. So yeah, I feel like that's been kind of front and center. Obviously it gets eclipsed with like kids' excitement about things and their activities, but I'd say the book is right there, it feels like at all times. At least right now. What about you? How are you doing?
I'm good. I love that you said uneasy because I feel like that's the descriptor that really fits. It's so exciting, and I know that we spend a lot of time being grateful for having the opportunity to put a book out in the world, and it's really stressful. I have so much respect for people who do this journey over and over and over again, and how often people do this alone, write a book on their own and get it out there. Having each other and with our writer Aaron has made this such a different journey, I'm sure. And yeah, it's stressful. I mean, we want it to do well. I think that's the hope of anyone who spends all this time and energy writing a book. You want it to get into people's hands and be helpful in some way. And also knowing that you can't control that. So what an epic lesson in controlling the controllables yet again, which seems to be my life's work, personally. So yeah, but other than that, I'm good. And as most people are winding down the school year, so am I, and I'm excited to get on the other side of this academic year for sure. So, but really quick on the note of the book, anybody who is listening who hasn't pre-ordered, this is a plug for you to pre-order the book. You can find it on anywhere that you buy books, but it actually really helps us if you purchase it from the big box store that you go to online. Amazon numbers really, truly help us. So, if you haven't had a chance to pre-order it and you want to do a little something for us, that might be the thing that we would wish that you could do for us in the short term and then tell your friends. So, shameless plugs for the book probably in the next couple episodes.
And the book is called The Price She Pays. I actually am kind of chuckling to myself because our family dog and I have a very funny dynamic. And I oftentimes, her name is Timber, but I oftentimes find myself calling her the dog. And I realized in this that both of us kept referring to it as the book
The
instead of
book.
The Price She Pays, which is its actual title. So maybe that's like a little illuminating how like we're kind of at that like tentious spot with it.
The
Oh, it's
book.
the book. Dun dun dun. So like the
So
price
true.
she pays. So whatever that means, we can psychoanalyze that later.
It does have a title. It does have an identity in and of itself. You're right. And yeah, we don't really talk about it that often. I don't even think the words come out of my mouth all that often anymore, the title of it. Very similarly to, it sounds like, how you refer to your sweet dog, Timber. So the dog. Well, we're going to get going here into our par for the course for this week. As you all may remember from the last episode, we're just trying something a little bit different. And We're not sure if we'll keep it. We'll see. We're waiting on some feedback from you all. And last time I came in with a news story and Katie didn't know anything about it. And we're doing the reverse today. So Katie's going to share some information. We break down kind of why it's the par for the course. And so, yeah, let's jump into that. What do you have, Katie?
Okay, I'm sorry. I have to put a quick pause really quick because last time Adam, who is my significant other, told me, he goes, "It's funny. You all told us what you were doing instead of just doing it." And I laughed and you just did it because, like, I was like, "Oh, that's very clinician-y of us, right? Like, we're going to explain to you what we are doing instead of just doing it and surprise you like that." And I even said this to him, and I was like, "Oh, that's what we do clinically. Like, I bet we do that all the time on sports drinks because that's what we do every time we're in a room with a client." No surprise here. Very overt. Here is what we are doing.
This is the behind the scenes of having two therapists running a podcast is everything's getting a little bit of a signal, almost as if we're trying to get consent and make
That's
sure that
correct.
everybody's on the same page before surprising anyone with anything. So you're right. Why we need to tell everybody that, I don't know, but we did. So
Tell us your thoughts. We won't do anything without your approval. This is a shared process. You are the leader of it,
if you've never
client.
been to therapy before, these are some of the things that hopefully you would hear.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. Okay, so here's my surprise part of the course for Tiffany. Okay, so I stumbled upon a, and what I want to say right now, very clinical of me, is I'm going to try to keep it as expansive as possible to get your thoughts. So I stumbled across an outside article that came out in May 2024, so recent article. The heading is "School Fitness Testing is a Nightmare. Should We Get Rid of It?" Schools have been measuring kids' fitness for decades using new controversial metrics like body mass index. California thinks there's a better way. So fascinating. It goes on to say, "Today, more than 10 million kids in over 20,000 schools across the US take a test called Fitnessgram annually. It's been California's official assessment since 1996. It also is used in New York City, the country's largest school district, and it's an official assessment of the presidential youth fitness program, the current iteration of more than 6 decades of federal initiatives targeting youth fitness," which of course led me down this like deep dive of the presidential fitness testing, which I don't know if any of you all remember, but I for sure remember as a kid. And found this New York Times article called "Could You Pass the Presidential Fitness Test Today?" And the presidential fitness test or program, as it started, for those of you who perhaps didn't have it, it was used in public schools. But the National Physical Fitness Testing Program, conducted in US public schools from the late 1950s to 2013, when it was then replaced with the Presidential Youth Fitness Program. And that's what the New York Times article was punctuating, that and that article came out in February 2024, that the intention of the switch was less about beating classmates and more about improving individual health. So this article then said that it's no longer a one size fits all approach. So we're looking at, how are we tracking physical fitness within a school system? And I want to be clear, this is outside of physical education classes and recess. So I'm going to leave it there and you jump in with your thoughts.
Oh, so many thoughts. Well, my first reaction is you said in the very beginning that the outside article talked about the school fitness using BMI as part of the scoring. So that brings me to an example of one of my nieces, one of my best friend's kids. She did a physical fitness, this exact same thing last year in middle school. I was actually taking care of the kids that week or something. I don't remember how it went. And she came home and told me what they did. And she had a lot of feelings about it because what happened was she liked some of the things that they were doing, and she actually felt pretty good about what she was able to do. And then they took the kids into a room with the principal and the nurse. Maybe I'm trying to remember who the other adult was. There was the principal, and then there was another adult in the room, and then each kid by themselves. And they went in the room and they weighed them, and then they gave them their BMI right there. And so she came home, she's telling me about this. At the time, she was either 12 or 13, and she knew right then that that wasn't okay. She knew that BMI was not a accurate indicator of health and fitness. And so we had this, dynamic conversation about that. So shout out to her for really understanding the weirdness of that. And then we talked about how for her school, how weird it was to be doing that with your principal. And I mean, not that anyone really makes sense, but the whole thing was just so freaking strange. So I have a lot of feelings about that for the sake of, utilizing BMI at such an early age, not to mention how debunked it's been over and over and over and over again as not being an indicator of health, but yet it continues to be utilized as a measurement. So to bring kids into that early on is just absolutely problematic from a million different perspectives. But the one that's most important is the research base that has told us over and over again not to use BMI as an indicator. So that's my first response. My second response is also I really killed it in the presidential fitness when I was a kid. So I am a little bit of mixed reaction here because I remember feeling really good about that, but also had no idea, like, what did it mean? It didn't mean anything. Like, what is it? And then at our in my age, so which was however many decades ago, I feel like they ranked us. Like we were in an order of students, and I was always at the top, which felt really good. Sometimes I was never the first, it was sometimes the second or the third. So I think, for those that are at the top, it can feel really good. But what does that mean for the kids that are in the middle or the bottom for a whole host of reasons? So, I do not feel good about anything that utilizes BMI, and especially you quoted 10 million. That's a significant number that is turning towards this. And I think you said every year. And so, yeah, that's my starting place. I do not like it. It's not good for the kids. The par for the course is how often we use BMI. And rather than just talking about movement and talking about, meeting kids where they're at with their, also their abilities, not to mention how many kids are not able to do the things that that test requires them to do because of not being able-bodied or in certain ways. So I just, all of it together is just gross. It's gross. And that's someone who really is, I believe in movement and fitness in schools and helping kids develop a positive, meaningful relationship to activity. But for it to come down to BMI as a part of that discussion will immediately turn me off. I don't know. What is your reaction?
No, I mean, so I have a lot of thoughts. And when I read these articles, that's why I did this deep dive because I was like fascinated. And I agree. The BMI crosses the line, right? The last episode, we talked about things within the bell curve and outside of the bell curve. BMI is outside of the bell curve. That should never be used. And what we know is even the most progressive pediatricians are no longer even weighing kids, like literally not even doing body weight because it's not an indicator of health and well-being. So that is like, and I mean, hello, let's talk about like shameful activities, things of like we hear Mary Kane's story, we hear athlete's story of who we're getting shamed for. Public weigh-ins and that being an indicator of ability or performance or health or well-being, whatever, weighing, there's so much more complexity to weight and BMI. So that is outside the bell curve. I do not like or endorse any part of that. Besides that, I love it. I am actually so disappointed that school systems no longer measure or celebrate perf like those kids who are able to excel physically. Because I think what we're doing within school systems is we're measuring so many things, right? What about kids with learning disabilities who are still expected to be in a reading group and they have to read and they have to do state testing and they have to do dibbles and all of these ways in which we're measuring academics? There then isn't room for kids who shine, whether it's in music or physical fitness. And in fact, anybody who's had a conversation with me, this is like perhaps one of my very favorite things to talk about. And I will give a shout out to my parents because from a very young age, they parented my sister and I using this philosophy, but it's the seven intelligences, which I'll cite for you all in case you're not familiar. Interpersonal, so seeing people's feelings and motives, logical, mathematical, quantifying things, making hypotheses, and proving them. Musical, discerning sounds, their pitch, tone, rhythm. Bodily kinesthetic, coordinating your mind and body. Naturalists, understanding living things and reading nature. Spatial, visualizing the world in 3D. Linguistic, finding the right words to express what you mean. And interpersonal, understanding yourself, what you feel, and what you need and want. And so I love that in terms of looking at the world, in terms of how are we celebrating each person's strengths. And for some, it's spatial. For some, it's logical and mathematical. For others, it's bodily kinesthetic. So how can we make sure in a school system that kids, not everybody has every strength, but everybody has a strength. So how are we celebrating that? And when we take things like the physical, whatever, and I don't care if it's this model, like what is it? The mile run, the sit up, push up, pull up, sit and reach, and shuttle run of the presidential fitness test. It doesn't have to be quantified in that way, but I think even, PTOs across America are no longer doing race, they're doing turning it into a fun run. And it's like, why? Like, why don't we? Some kids literally are faster than other kids. It doesn't mean they're better than other kids. It just means they're like faster. Just like some kids are better readers than other kids. It doesn't mean they're better humans than other kids. It just means they're more proficient at reading. And so I think I would love to see the celebration of all strengths, not just physical fitness, but that's what we're talking about today, but this integration of celebrating strengths, and that this is a way of doing it that I would love to see integrated into the school system because that's how some kids feel a place of belonging.
I like what you're saying about it being about belonging, and the missing link is when schools aren't doing that with, if you're just thinking about kids' well-being, when kids don't have an opportunity to do that in other arenas. And so then it does become just on physical fitness or grades, as if those are the only two levels of kind of goodness within kids. And that's the part that I always have a really strong reaction to is because when we've talked about this before, I've always been like, I don't agree. I don't see it the same way. But I think it's because there's not other places for other kids to be seen and celebrated with their particular talents and their particular skills or passions. And so it ends up being either you're the smart kid or you're the jock, so to speak. And then those are the two things that get attention for being good enough or praised, I guess, is part of it, is that that's where the praise comes in. And the kids who are good at music or good at art or good at theater or good at math or other things don't get the same level of response within the school system. And so, if the system, shocking that that's where my answer is going to come, if the system was set up in such a way where it honored all those other layers, then hell yeah, like let's make it so kids who have this particular skill and talent can be celebrated. I also don't think it's helpful to water it down so much where it's a fun run and there can be no competition attached to it. I think I would argue rather than it being one or the other, that it be both and that you can enter and be competitive or you can enter and just have a good time and that you get to choose whatever makes the most sense for you. And I think we put so much emphasis sometimes on being, it's like the every kid gets a trophy, so let's make it so it's easy for everybody. I don't agree with that, but I also don't agree with the long-standing historical way that you have to be top, 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 top kid or adult to be recognized for your talents. And there's a middle ground in there that we seem to have somehow missed.
Totally. And I think we're seeing this tipping point clinically, right? Of like kids expecting themselves to be the top, 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 top across the board. That they should embody all of these seven intelligences. And like that actually isn't feasible, right? So, no, you're not going to be the top, 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 top at all of these things, but you are the top, top, top at something. And let's help each kid learn what that is for them. And absolutely, we need arts and theaters and musics, and we need all of this accessible to kids, so that they can find their thing where they really excel. And we need to then celebrate that for them without watering it down of like, then not everybody's going to be Picasso, but like some kids are going to be closer than other kids. That's okay. It doesn't, I like your language of not watering it down of, and it doesn't mean it isn't fluid, right? I think the biggest thing too is like different things and different life cycle stages, you can evolve into a new skill set. So don't ever shut the door on working hard at an area that may be an area of growth or that you maybe want to improve upon, if there always is room for improvement as well. It's not like you're, this is a fixed equation that because this is then your lane. It's like, no, stay expansive and keep exposing yourself to a variety of things and activities.
Yeah, I like that you found this article because I know we differ on it in some ways, and I think we differ because we know that the systems are not designed to play it out well for all kids. And that's the part that becomes pretty difficult. And I think about I always think about the kids who have all those other skill sets or, like that list of intelligence. And they just don't get recognized in school. They don't get seen as being important or valued. And so they don't have a place of belonging. And that's the system. That's not the kids. And kids are going to respond to the way the system sets it up. So the schools, and I think it's like this for a lot of schools, are the kids who are really good at sports and they get their pictures put in the gym and they get kind of all the attention that comes from school assemblies and, let's go out and watch them play, which of course there's some traditions in there, but there's not that same energy for the kids who are doing different things on a middle school or high school campus. And I'm sad for that because I think that, those are the kids that oftentimes who don't have that place of belonging, who don't feel seen and heard by their peers, miss out on some pretty significant, meaningful connections that could inevitably be protective factors for them. So that's a, I mean, I know that's a rabbit hole that could take us in a bunch of different directions, but BMI bad, physical
BMI
activity
is
good.
bad. Correct. Yes,
Bottom
correct.
line.
Celebrate all kids, big on inclusivity, and we don't need to, we need to meet people where they're at, and that's going to fall on a whole spectrum of places.
Well, cool. Thanks for that. We're gonna get into our topic for today, and we're lucky to get another call. Thank you for responding to our request for calls into the show and letting us know the things that you'd like us to talk about in regards to mental health and in sports. And so let's go ahead and turn to our listener call for today.
Hey guys, this is Carter from Oregon. My question for you guys is, as a student athlete myself, I've seen my fair share of people be sidelined from their sports, whether it's due to physical injury, or personal or mental health problems. My question would be, due to how big of an issue mental health is now, especially for student athletes, is there a possibility that people are now using it, as an excuse or as a way to get out of, practice or even sporting events, rather than having a real issue, with their mental health. That's about all I got for you guys, and thank you.
Okay, well, I think this is a question we haven't really tackled this together. This idea of, the way that sometimes mental health is used or seen as made up or exaggerated or an excuse. So this is a good conversation for us to have. Do you have any immediate thoughts, Katie?
Yeah, one of my first thoughts is I am so glad this question is being asked. So thank you, because when we were writing The Price She Pays, rather than the
Oh,
book, if you will,
the book.
the book done, is I kept coming back to Aaron and Tiffany, and my panic spot always was, are we holding athletes accountable? Are we making sure that we're not saying that they can do whatever they want and that they can, mental health is basically a free pass? Like, are we making sure that athletes also, we're very clear that there are expectations in sports. And there were multiple times when I had that kind of reaction, because I do believe that, well, also know the validity of mental health, but I do know that those can coexist. So I love that we're going to kind of flesh through this, because it is complex. And so many of our conversations have been around trusting and believing the athlete, which we always will say to do. And if it feels as though there is a wondering around, well, then what do we do with the mental health needs? What is the impact, and how I don't want to say is if the athlete is accurately reporting, but that's what I'm kind of hearing in this question of what do we then do with that? I think it's a nuanced thing to flush through. So expectations need to be clear. I mean, not to get on my soapbox again, but this is why preseason team agreements are critical, because then you know how to respond instead of having to react in this face of crisis. There's already really clear expectations and protocol in place. So, I mean, obviously, I'm so excited by the question because I'm kind of all over the place. What were your first thoughts?
I similarly to what you're saying, and I'm going to this place of considering that if there's some question about the validity of someone's kind of mental health or the severity of their symptoms, or, are they just trying to get out of practice? Are they trying to get out of competition? These kind of things that we've heard, from coaches that we've worked with. And I think to me, I just immediately consider how if there's two things. One, I think a coach or someone who's not trained in mental health cannot say for certain whether or not something is made up or not. Because oftentimes, in systems where, especially with coaches who have so much power and influence over an athlete, but the way that an athlete may report it to a coach or an assistant coach, or a trainer, for example, may not be in full accuracy to begin with because they're trying to test the waters and trying to see what is okay to talk about, what's not okay to talk about. Will people believe me? Will they understand me? Will they care about me? So I think from a baseline perspective, it's hard for me to make sense of, that decision being made in isolation without consultation with whoever's working with an athlete around their mental health. So, setting that aside, I also think that if there is, and I'm playing this out on the possibility that someone is, utilizing, we've heard people say something like weaponizing their mental health, for example, in terms of their athletics. Is then to me, that is an extension of what's happening for them in terms of their mental health or the relationship within the system. So to me, it's all part of one package in the sense of if something's going on and the only way I can kind of get out of it is to say, like, I don't think I can do this. My mental health is a part of this. To me, that's part of the package of struggling with mental health and that. A coach or someone in a position who's trying to understand that doesn't have to fully vet that or understand it in its entirety to understand that something's happening for them that's impacting their capacity to participate. And whether that be participate in practice or participate in competition or training blocks or whatever it is. But I know that, what you and I've discussed so many times is that doesn't change that there's still an expectation within the athletic system. So that may all be true. And it may be that someone's really suffering. There might be a lot happening for them. They might not fully even understand themselves what's happening. They're not sure how much they can practice. They're not sure how much they can, talk to someone about what's going on. So a lot of that might be occurring. But from a coach or an athletic program standpoint, they still need to get, quote unquote, the job done. And so the expectations are still the expectations. And so to me, it's all about then what happens and how it happens, not so much about like assuming they're lying or assuming, that they're trying to get out of something. That all to me is just like we have to take those things at face value. Like we're not going to catch somebody in a mental health lie, for example. We take people at face value, like you said, and we believe them. And there are natural consequences when we can't compete or we can't practice or we can't participate in the way that maybe we were able to before.
Totally. And I think that's such a big piece of this is it can be both, right? We can believe you and what needs to happen. Just like if somebody breaks their ankle, we believe you that your ankle is broken and you now are not going to be on our travel squad because your ankle is broken, so you cannot run. And that is going to impact you playing the game. It is the same thing with mental health. And I would say we have average systems for incorporating injured athletes into the team dynamic still. So we have room for improvement for physical ailments. We have hordes of room for improvement for mental health needs, right? But what we need to at least be starting with is a protocol. So if somebody has a mental health need that is impacting their ability to meet the team expectations, which is be at practice on time, have a good attitude, hustle, contribute XYZ stats, all of those things are part of sport. Those should not go away. If you cannot meet those expectations, in because of mental health needs, here is going to be our system to be able to help you recover, to be able to make it back to the team. So it's not that you are like we heard athletes share in the book writing process that they were told to leave campus and never welcomed back because they had a mental health need. That is the wrong response, right? It is about how do we help you rehab, to use physical health language. How do we help you rehab to be able to get back onto the team so that you can be a contributing member that you can then play within the agreements and expectations that the program has? And so that's what we need to build out is how is that conversation being handled and what, and then what does happen so that there isn't then this guesswork happening of when an athlete comes, because you're saying it's hard to quantify. Athletes oftentimes can't say, well, because of my depression, X, Y, and Z is happening, right? It's not as quantifiable as I have a broken ankle. I need to rehab for 8 weeks. It isn't as prescriptive as that. However, we need to treat it the same way. And the athlete also, I think about redshirt seasons, like this would, if you're in a college system, this would be like a redshirt season kind of thing. So I think we do need to have some systems built out.
I would layer an extra thing in there, though, is that you're right in terms of the way that physical ailments or like broken ankle or, like tore a particular something, something, something can't play. Like there's, it can be reduced down to clarity around this is the injury and this is what the process is in order to rehab it back and get back into training capacity. However, what is so challenging about mental health is depression for one athlete might fuel them in some ways to get out there and actually be some do some of their best athletic work, where another athlete, same diagnosis, quote unquote, in terms of having, let's say anxiety or depression or something else, might actually be the thing that needs what you're saying in terms of I need to take a pause, I need to get help, I need to seek out support. And I think that's what gets really confusing for coaching systems and athletic programs because one athlete who's suffering with something may do really well to continue. And another athlete who's suffering with something regarding mental health may need to take a pause. And that's, I think to the credit of mental health or to athletic systems, that's really confusing. It's not as straightforward as, oh, broken ankle, you're out for the season. I remember this talk I was giving to all the coaches of this D1 program, and a coach came up to me and was really inquisitive about how do I even talk to my athlete who I can tell is struggling. She's crying a lot. But she's performing really well. And she said, I don't know if I don't want to kind of break her stride. I don't want to mess up her, open up something that she doesn't want to talk about. There was a lot of like tiptoeing around this particular athlete. And so we had a conversation about what would it be like to be, very visibly having an experience and others not asking you about it. And so really checked in with this particular coach about how to go and talk with this athlete about what she was experiencing. And with this idea of, do you want to talk about it? Do you want additional support? Do you not want additional support? Do you want to just keep on moving? Really giving what you and I say a lot, giving them the options of what that could look like. But there are times where we know that because of someone's struggle with mental health, it is going to significantly decrease their output or their capacity to be competitive. And that's okay. That's the part that has to be named and believed and accepted, because what's not okay is what you just mentioned, that example where it was like, don't ever come back to campus. Or what I think several stories in the book noted is that women had this experience of having significant mental health needs, were told by their coaches or their athletic program, oh my gosh, go get help. We totally support you. You're going to have a spot on the team. Seemingly very supportive. They took the time off. They followed everything that was supposed to happen. And then when they came back to campus in order to train and join the team, that they said they no longer had a spot for them. Those are the things that are not okay. But yeah, I guess I'm kind of going off on quite the tangent here, because I think what I get so frustrated about, and it like deep in my soul frustrated about, is this kind of say one thing, do another when it comes to mental health needs for athletes. And so a system that's saying, we got you, we'll get you help, we want to support you, but then they don't follow through with their end of it, is really, really frustrating. And to me, is an extension of how mental health issues continue to be kind of punished.
And we heard this a lot, right? Systems or coaches or athletic directors saying some version of the language, it's a liability, right? And that's, I mean, that's the wrong response. That's a fear-based response of, but if the person ends up doing XYZ, is that going to fall on us? And that's a liability. So we're just going to have them go away. It's like, well, that's a, like, I mean, that would be a lazy response, right? No, that is there's a significant amount of lack of knowledge in that of there does need to be attending to, and you're absolutely correct that mental health presents in a variety of different ways, and different people need different things, and sometimes in a crisis it's hard to know what you need. But I've actually yet to meet anybody who can have the laser clear focus when they're in a crisis or an escalated spot to say, here's going to be the best intervention for me. The blinders come on and all of a sudden we're looking through a straw instead of seeing the whole landscape. So nobody does their best problem solving in an acute state. Your nervous system is dysregulated. It would be so impossible to have clarity. And I think the whole theme, actually, what's emerging from this episode is this place of belongingness, right? So we have whatever it's going to mean for the person, there has to be a way to stay hooked into the system. And I, even when I was at Oregon, I didn't even really, I don't know what was happening. But I wasn't competing, right? I wasn't meeting the program's expectation of output and performance. And that was valid. I wasn't. That was completely accurate. But what they told me was, don't come back to practice until you're in competition shape. And it was the worst thing that could have possibly happened. And I never ended up showing back up to practice because under that program, I never got back into competing shape because that was a very daunting lift. And so I think what we do know about mental health is feeling a sense of belonging and connectivity goes a very long way, even though the need might be different. And for some people to intentionally leave campus or take a pause, that's very different than being told not to come back until mm-hmm. you're able to prove your worth, mm-hmm. right? Because your worth as a human is still intact, even if you are not producing the results. But in athletic systems, we so oftentimes equate those to one another, when in reality, those are two different things. You might not be producing results, and that's just matter of fact, but it doesn't mean you aren't still a solid human.
And that there aren't ways to still contribute. And what I struggle with what you're naming here and what your experience was, is this idea of like, get away from us until you're good enough to be back with us versus... Mm-hmm. You know, I could see a boundary to say you've got to meet these specifications sure. in order to be, you know, to practice on these particular days or to be, you know, whatever it may be. But also, what does it look like to seek out and offer support in that way? Here, let's talk about some training blocks. Let's talk about what needs to happen next. Let's, you know, is there someone on the team that you think would be useful for you to train with that we could turn towards and seek out some support? And, you know, this kind of, we're going to turn away from you because you're not doing what we want, is the core, I think, for a lot of mental health, like, wounds over time, and especially in athletics. And I think because of what you're naming, the idea of what athletics can be for people is such a place of belonging, such a place of belonging. And I would extend this. I haven't given this enough thought. So this is like off the cuff idea. So we'll see where it lands in about 2 minutes. Is that as I was saying that, I was imagining how that would be for a fan, for example. So imagine being a fan of your favorite sport, which, you know, part of being a fan is this feeling of belonging. I'm a part of something. I'm, you know, I'm cheering on and I'm going with the highs and the lows of being a fan of this particular team or this particular athlete. And then if someone came along and said, sorry, dude, the way that you're doing this is just not working for us anymore. Your behavior isn't working for us. You're gonna have to leave and never come back. Or you're going to have to leave and do A, B, and C before we'll allow you to come back. But this kind of game that seems to get played with athletes, can you imagine that playing out with fans? Which, again, you and I would say, yeah, there are some fans that need to be banned from coming into a stadium because of their behavior. Absolutely. And if it's harmful, if it's racist, if it's going, you know, like there's a lot of reasons why someone should not be able to come back into a stadium. But in the same way for athletes, if an athlete is causing harm by their behavior, those boundaries make sense to me. But if we're not facilitating this sense of belonging and connection, then what are we even doing all this for? And, you know, not to get so existential on it, but it makes me think of Nikki Hiltz had this incredible quote recently and was talking about what happened at the Oregon State track meet, which I'll let others kind of look up and maybe we'll talk about in a future episode. But what Nikki had said was they named this idea of, you know, everyone should be welcomed into our sport. And if this is, you know, what you're able to get out of track and field, you should be able to step in and benefit from and feel seen and heard and the sense of connection and belonging. And it stayed with me, their words stayed with me through, you know, thinking about a couple other types of sports and situations where, like you're saying, this mental health need to step away at times to take care of self. Like, we all have to step away. We need a mental health day. We need a chance to turn towards ourselves and take care of ourselves, just like we need sick days for physical ailments. But we got to know that it's a place that we get to come back to. And when the systems turn away from athletes because of what's happening, that is, by the way, audience, I hope you know this by now from us, mental health stuff is not within the control of the person who's navigating it. They have they're, hopefully finding ways to be in control of the controllables in terms of some symptoms or some strategies to help with it. But no one's waking up and being like, oh, my life's amazing. I'm so glad I have depression. It's really, I'm so glad I chose depression for myself. It's what the hand that's been dealt to them. And so, to have some compassion and to, as Nikki said, really continuing to bring people into the realm of what sport can offer them in terms of belonging, I think that's the name of the game.
Absolutely, absolutely. I work with a pediatric provider who says this so beautifully, but she'll say, and I'm probably going to butcher it. I wish she were here to actually quote herself, but she says some version of when working with kids and teens that mental health symptomology is not your fault, but it is your responsibility for how you're going to live with it. And I think that is a really good takeaway for in sport too, right? It's not, we want people to feel a sense of belonging. It is not their fault for these things that are coming up. And there is an element of responsibility of, and what are you going to do with it, right? How are you going to, if you want to be a part of this team, we want you here, but you have to want to be here, right? And you have to take responsibility for the things that are getting in the way of you being able to show up your fullest. It is everybody's responsibility on any team, sports or otherwise, to do what they can to contribute to what their requirements are on that team. And so I love her language of that, of looking at it from, oh, it doesn't get to just be this free pass, right? Of, well, I have anxiety, so I can't show up to practice. It's like, whoa, it's not that simple. You have anxiety, and how are you going to show up to practice?
And
Right? If showing up to practice.
how can we set practice up in such a way, or how can we support you in terms of accommodation so that you can come and do your best as well?
Totally. I mean, it's two-pronged in that sense, right? Absolutely. We need systems that have our mental health informed at a minimum. And what is that going to look like, right? How I, that, like, just slapping it down of like, it's anxiety or it's depression or all of those things are really valid. And there are outcomes that are necessary in sport and in life, that there are expectations. And this is, I mean, I know I said I'd get off my soapbox, but I'm going to come back to it really fast of like when that can be communicated up front in early season so that the expectations are clear versus what you're saying. And I agree with this wholeheartedly. It's when it's this moving target of, oh, wait, player A can miss 17 practices, but I can only miss one. And then I have consequences. There are consistent and clear expectations communicated at the very upfront of practices by leadership so that athletes know what framework they're working within. Ideally, these agreements are set collectively so that everybody gets to contribute and have, some understanding and make these contributions. But that being front loaded can save some of this agony at the back end.
And for it to be something that the system is taking responsibility to make happen and to be communicative and to notice when their expectations are skewed one way for one athlete and not for another. I think when the system starts, putting all the work on the athletes, I think about it similarly into the systems in which I work in, which are focused on, students and academic performances. But yeah, if we're not willing to look at our own ways that we set it up, then, we're really not making it possible for athletes or students to thrive. And so I'm so glad we got this question today because I think that we've talked about this before where we're saying like, oh, we're not trying to make athletes soft and we know that they can achieve a lot and we know that the systems can help them do that. But I think there is continuously a misunderstanding of, mental health needs are important. It's the thing we care about deeply. And it's the responsibility of all of us, including people who are suffering with mental health, diagnoses or symptoms, to communicate themselves to what they need so we can all work really well together to achieve whatever it is that someone's trying to achieve, whether it's a dominant season, a new stat line, a new PR, whatever it is, but that there's clarity about how that's going to happen. So thank you for the question and for giving us an opportunity to think that through. That was definitely kind of all came together on the essence of belongingness, like you said. So I appreciate you naming that, Katie. Well, that's it for us today. And, you know, a few plugs here. You can go visit us on our website at athletesmentalhealthfoundation.org. You can also find us on Instagram with the same handle, Athletes Mental Health Foundation. And then you can also pre-order the book called The Price She Pays, and know that we would just be so appreciative if you took the time to do that. And maybe even if you let us know, we get those numbers about every week right now. And we love to see them climbing. And once again, thanks for being with us on Sports Shrinks. We come to you every other week and appreciate you taking the time to listen to us.
Thank you. Thank you.